Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today are Ty Yoakum and Matt Popish, both from Aspen High School. They will be interviewing Bela Bauer, who works at Station Q, Microsoft's research center located on the University of California, Santa Barbara campus. Bela is a theoretical physicist who works at the intersection of condensed matter theory and quantum information theory. After completing his PhD at ETH Zurich on the topic of tensor network states, a class of numerical tools that are inspired by quantum information theory but are used to address problems primarily in condensed matter theory. That was a big mouthful, Bela. He joined Station Q. There, he's continued to work on information theoretic approaches to condensed matter systems, as well as a variety of other problems ranging from topological phases, the exotic systems that form the cornerstone of Microsoft's unique approach to quantum computing, to non-equilibrium systems such as time crystals, as well as algorithms and applications for quantum computers. That all sounds very esoteric, and we hope to make it totally understandable to our radio audience. But this you will understand. He is also an avid mountain cyclist and enjoys camping, hiking, and exploring in the wild places of the American West, and has done a tremendous amount of that while he's been here in Aspen. Welcome, Bela, and we'll begin today with Matt.
First of all, I was wondering, when did you know you wanted to become a physicist?
Actually, very early on. I think my dad told me that when I was like 9 years old, I had said that I wanted to become a theoretical physicist. Oh, really? And yeah, so I read like when I was 10, 12 years old, I started reading like popular science books and like biographies of, you know, Einstein and Feynman and so on. I thought it was super cool. And yeah, I guess I just, as long as I can remember, I wanted to be a theoretical physicist.
Not that many people know from such an early age.
Yeah.
Did that help you along your road in school and other education?
Yeah, it probably did. It keeps you focused. And I did a lot of reading outside of school about physics, so I was always kind of, you know, one step ahead. I like read ahead in the physics textbooks, like read the next chapter while the class was working on some other chapter. So it's definitely staying ahead on that. And yeah, if you have, you know, a goal like that, it sort of directs everything you do, maybe, you know. You have some kind of long-term game plan of how you're going to achieve what you're trying to achieve.
So at the moment, you're working at Station Q for Microsoft.
Yeah.
Can you kind of explain like what you do there, what their goals are?
Yeah, definitely. So Station Q has been in Santa Barbara for about 10 years, and the goal of the group is to build a topological quantum computer, which is a particular kind of quantum computer. So it's using topological phases of matter to solve one of the inherent difficulties of building a quantum computer, which is how you protect the information. And so it's a theory group that's been around for a while researching this particular direction. I'm a computational physicist in the group. So most of my work is doing computer simulations of the systems that, you know, go into building this topological quantum computer. And yeah, so my work involves, you know, all kinds of research specifically on quantum computing, but we also do sort of broader research just in condensed matter theory. You know, that hopefully will help us build a quantum computer one day. Hopefully one day pretty soon.
Yeah.
Could you possibly explain the difference between quantum computing and classical computing?
Yeah, totally. So a classical computer, the information is stored in a classical bit, at least in what we call a digital quantum computer. So bits are just 0 or 1. And so that's what we call a classical state. In a quantum computer, you replace this classical bit that can just be in a state 0 or 1 with what's called a qubit, a quantum bit. And so a quantum bit can store information in a more general sense, if you wish. So the way this is often phrased is that a qubit is you know, not just in the state 0 or 1, but has more states, can sort of be between 0 and 1 in what we call quantum superposition. This is often called being in 0 and 1 at the same time, which isn't quite precise language, but is maybe a reasonable picture to have in mind. So it's you know, somewhere between 0 and 1. The confusing rules of quantum mechanics tell you that you can't observe this, so once you measure it, it collapses to 0 or 1. But while, you know, while you're not observing it, it's in a state in between, and that allows you to do processing in more general ways. So this really gets interesting once you have a lot of qubits, and then they can be entangled with each other. So they collectively contain a more general state than what you could store in a classical computer. And so this all sounds really esoteric and is probably hard to understand without knowing more about the rules of quantum mechanics. But the bottom line is that it allows us to do computations that are really hard for a classical computer. So the classical example that people always cite is factoring large integer numbers, which is a really important problem in cryptography. It's one of those things that's really hard to do for a classical computer. So if I give you a bunch of integer numbers, you can multiply them together. But the hard part is sort of doing the reverse. So you want to find the prime factors for a very large integer, an integer with thousands and thousands of digits. That turns out to be, to the best of our knowledge, exponentially hard on a classical computer, which means that, say, every time you add one digit to your number that you're trying to decompose into its prime factors, it gets, say, twice as hard. So it's really hard to do on a classical computer, and a lot of encryption schemes are based on this. And it turns out that this problem is actually much easier for a quantum computer. So there's a famous algorithm developed by Peter Shor in 1994 called Shor's algorithm, which solved this problem. And this is really the thing that sort of put quantum computing on the map as a relevant technology. Because if you can do this, you know, it would have huge impact on encryption of data. So that's one class of things you could try to study. The other natural application, which is where actually Richard Feynman first thought about quantum computers, is in the context of simulating quantum systems. So in all kinds of applications like material science and pharmaceuticals, you know, quantum chemistry, you're trying to simulate the behavior of a quantum system. So some system at very low temperatures or some chemical reaction where quantum effects play an important role. And since quantum theory is, in a sense, a more powerful theory of nature, it's also, you know, it makes sense that it's hard to simulate on a classical computer. Classical computer follows, you know, classical rules. Quantum mechanics follows a more general set of rules. So a classical computer that is sort of restricted to live in this classical world has a really hard time simulating a quantum system that, you know, has a more general set of rules that it follows. So you need to develop a computer that has, you know, plays by the same rules as the system that you're simulating. And so this is one really big area of applications that we're looking into, where we hope that a quantum computer can be really helpful.
So have you made any headway in simulating some of these quantum systems with these new quantum computers, so to speak?
Actually, very recently, the answer is yes. We at Microsoft haven't, but other groups working on this have. I mean, quantum computers are just, you know, you could argue that even though research has been going on for 15, 20 years, only in the last, really in the last few months have we seen sort of sizable quantum computers with more than just a few qubits. So two-qubit systems have been around for a while, but the last year or two, there's been, you know, a big push by Microsoft and Google and IBM and other companies to build bigger quantum computers. And so now the biggest systems that I know of have on the order of 15 to 20 qubits, where you can actually start doing meaningful quantum simulations. And so there's been a couple of papers just really in the last few months that have shown some very impressive simulations of quantum systems with quantum computers. Of course, I should say that at this point, the quantum computers are still so small that we can classically simulate it. So small quantum systems we can do on a classical computer. And of course, you know, that's a problem that computational physicists have been working on since the 50s or 40s. So we have, you know, a huge head start with classical computers of like well-established methods and so on. So right now the quantum computers can't simulate anything that, you know, you couldn't simulate on even the tiniest classical computer. I mean, these simulations you can repeat on your iPhone if you wish. But it's an impressive first step, and we hope that, you know, if we keep pushing on improving the technology of quantum computers in a few years, we'll be able to simulate systems that we can't simulate on a classical computer.
Is this related all to like quantum teleportation?
Yeah, quantum teleportation is related. So there's sort of two broad classes of quantum technologies. One is quantum computation, where you're trying to solve, you know, a computational problem with this type of quantum computer. The other area is quantum communication, which is trying to use, you know, quantum mechanics to, well, do a couple of things. One thing you can do is you can just communicate quantum states over long distances, and that's this teleportation. Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of research going into that direction. I was just this morning looking at a paper by a group in China that has this quantum space communication satellite. Yeah. So they've demonstrated quantum teleportation over, I think, 1,400 kilometers, yeah, which is really impressive.
I saw that too.
Another goal with this is, so quantum communication allows you to do something like quantum key distribution. So that's a encryption scheme, basically, that, or secure communication. It's called a secure communication scheme that uses the laws of quantum mechanics. And so it's very plausible to think that even if you have a quantum computer, you cannot crack that kind of encryption, because it is harnessing the laws of quantum mechanics to do secure communication. And so that's a whole other big research effort. That's actually the one that's probably coming to markets sooner than quantum computation. And I believe you can actually go out and buy quantum key distribution systems already. That use fiber optics. Really? I think there's a company in Switzerland that makes quantum communication devices.
Wow, yeah, that's impressive.
Back to a simple question. Why is Aspen Center for Physics special, and why do you like it?
It's just a great place to come and focus on research. You know, it's if I'm at home in Santa Barbara, there's always a lot of distractions. You know, there's students and classes, and I mean, I don't teach, but there's still, you know, the university campus is busy, and there's talks going on all the time, and there's just a lot of distraction. And when you come to Aspen, you can pick out just a particular thing that you're going to work on, and you can focus on it almost without distraction. I mean, there's a few talks going on here at Aspen, which are always really interesting, but it's a place where we can really focus on research and just not pay attention to all the other distractions of daily life. And then there's always, you know, a lot of great people around, so the discussion's always really interesting. You know, and as opposed to other conferences where you have, you know, 10 talks a day, in the coffee breaks you're really tired. Here, because there's, you know, a lot of time, you can actually discuss at length and have more in-depth discussion than, you know, at some other conference where in the coffee break, you know, you have like a 2-minute discussion with someone and you think, oh, this sounds really interesting, but we're not going to have time to discuss this in any detail. Here you can actually, you know, sit down, sit outside and have a, you know, have a good discussion and understand what other people are working on and what the new developments in the field are. And so, yeah, it's really nice that way. And then, of course, it's also nice to bring the family and enjoy what Aspen has to offer.
So have these, like, talks and discussions with other physicists helped you in your research with Floquent time crystals? I'm not sure.
Floquet time crystals?
Yes.
That's actually not something that we did here. But yeah, that's been a really, really fun direction and has gotten some attention. I mean, we've had some talks on driven systems this year. Last year we had a program where we had a lot of talks on time crystals and related systems.
So what basically are time crystals?
Yeah.
Can you explain that a little bit more in depth?
So a time crystal is a system that spontaneously breaks time translation symmetry. So symmetries are really fundamental in all aspects of physics. I think arguably the most fundamental aspect of physics is understanding the symmetries of nature. And a lot of the laws of nature can be understood in terms of the symmetries. And this is a really important aspect of physics. And symmetry breaking is... you know, is in everyday life around us. So, you know, space is translationally invariant, but if you look at the things that are in front of you, they manifestly break this translation invariance, because you know you look at it and from different angles it looks different. So that's breaking rotational invariance, And then, you know, metals or any material has a crystal structure which breaks the translational symmetry of just nature, basically. So spontaneous symmetry breaking happens everywhere. Magnets, for example, break what we call spin rotational symmetry. So usually the spins in a system would not align. You know, usually they should be invariant under rotating all the spins. But if you have a ferromagnet, spontaneously all the spins in that system decide to align because of, you know, the interactions between the spins make that sort of a favorable condition, and that gives you, say, a ferromagnet. So breaking of all these symmetries is really everywhere in nature. And has been sort of the way that we think about condensed matter physics, at least since the 50s, since Landau developed what's called the Landau theory for symmetry breaking, Ginzburg-Landau theory. But there's been a few sort of holdouts. So we know, you know, translational symmetry breaking leads to crystals, and rotational symmetry breaking, spin symmetry breaking leads to magnets. But one of the fundamental symmetries of nature, which is time translation symmetry, was sort of not part of that. People didn't think about systems that spontaneously break this time translation symmetry of the laws of nature. And a few years ago, I think it was 2006 or 2008, Frank Wilczek sort of first hypothesized that there could be systems that break time translation symmetry much in the same way that a crystal breaks translational symmetry in space. And that's where the name time crystal comes from. He came up with that name, which you know, very descriptive, because it is really like a crystal, but not in space, but in time. So at the time, he hypothesized the existence of these phases of matter and tried to construct examples. And then following that, there was a big discussion in the community about whether these things are real, you know, what it really means to break time translation symmetry. You know, you have to develop a new formalism, because we usually think of, you know, the way that we usually mathematically think about symmetry breaking isn't maybe straightforwardly applicable to time translation symmetry, just because we didn't think about that. And so I think at the time, the conclusion was actually that these time crystals don't exist. So the original examples that Frank Wilczek came up with, I think the conclusion after some, you know, back and forth in the literature was that those aren't actually examples of time crystals. What happened in the last 4 or 5 years is that we had a better understanding of non-equilibrium phases of matter. So the reason why this is important is that a time crystal is sort of necessarily a phase that's not in equilibrium. That's sort of the point of a time crystal. If you're in equilibrium, it means that it's time translation invariant. That's sort of the definition of being in equilibrium. So we had to find a way to keep a system out of equilibrium to have this time crystal behavior. Because otherwise, you can't just have any interesting time dependence, really. And so starting in 2010, we developed, and by we, I mean the entire community of condensed matter theorists, developed a good understanding of a phase of matter that's called many-body localization. And many-body localization is, I don't want to go too much into the details, but it's a phase of matter that sort of robustly avoids equilibrating. So, you know, most systems that you encounter in daily life, they equilibrate. Like if you take a system and you heat it up at one end, eventually the energy will spread out through the system and the whole system will be at the same temperature. That's one example of a process of equilibration. Or you can mix two fluids of different color together. Eventually, the whole system will have a homogeneous color. All those are examples of equilibration. Many-body localization doesn't do this. So if you take a many-body localized system and you heat it up at one end, the other end never gets hot. The energy just doesn't spread through the system. And so it was only recently understood that this is sort of a robust phenomenon in nature that can actually exist, at least in theoretical models. And this gave us a new perspective on the possibility of having time crystals. So now the way you find these time crystals generally is in what's called a driven system. So this is the Floquet part of that name. So Floquet system is a system where you do something periodically. You know, you just, in some sense, you kick it every, you know, after some time. And you just keep doing that. And before we understood many-body localization, we thought that, you know, a system where you just periodically act on it in some way, it would, you know, you're applying energy, you're doing work on that system when you kick it. And you would think that just heats up the system and the system would equilibrate to some new equilibrium state and nothing interesting would happen. Many-body localization can now prevent that from happening in these driven systems. And that allows us to have sort of new phases of matter in these driven systems. So it's a combination of this localization, which is preventing equilibration of the system, and then doing something periodically to the system. Now, the objection you should have is, if I'm periodically doing something to the system, I've already broken time translational invariance, sort of explicitly, right? I do something periodically in time. Well, now, you know, my system isn't just invariant under looking at it in different times. What happens is that this periodicity gets broken down even further. So say you kick the system every second, a time crystal would now exhibit some oscillatory behavior at a longer period. So for example, it would look the same, but only every 2 seconds or every 4 seconds or some multiple of the period at which you're doing work on the system. And so this is an example of a system breaking time translational invariance. So the universe, so to speak, is acting on the system every second, but it's replying to us every 2 seconds. That's sort of a way to think about time translation symmetry breaking, and that's sort of the essence of these time crystals.
Wow.
Okay, that was probably a bit too much.
We have time.
Well,
we have time for one more question.
So going back to those, like, mini bodies or
many body localization?
Yeah, mini body localization. Yeah. Do you guys know exactly how it's not, like, spreading the energy evenly through the system, or
the reason that doesn't happen is because excitations of the system are sort of stuck. So you can, so these systems have strong disorder, so they're sort of very dirty. You can imagine it's like, you know, being in the mountains and, you know, you have some particles trying to dissipate heat. Some particle has to get from one valley over to the other valley, and the mountains in between are just too high, so the particle doesn't have enough energy to make it over the mountain pass.
Oh, okay.
So that's sort of an analogy. That's simplifying it a little bit there, because this this now sounds like a completely classical phenomenon. For it to actually happen, you need quantum mechanics, and sort of quantum interference plays a crucial role in that. But that's probably getting a little bit too complicated. But the basic picture you can have in mind is that the particles in such a many-body localized system live in sort of a very mountainous landscape, and they just can't get over the mountains.
For those of you who listened all the way through this interview, I hope it's inspiring. It's interesting how far from the daily conversations we've ventured in physics, and I do find it inspiring, and I hope you will too. So we have been talking with Bela Bauer, who is at Station Q, Microsoft's research center at the University of Santa Barbara, and with Ty Yoakum and Matt Popish from Aspen High School, who are our gophers this week. So thank you all. It was a really interesting conversation, Bela, even if we didn't understand it all. Tune in to Radio Physics on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 4:30. And for more information about our Gopher program and events at the center, please visit our website, Aspen Center for Physics, aspenphys.org, or give us a call,